and welcome to the Movie Marketing and Distribution Podcast presented by UsherU. My name is Alex Stoltz. I head up film strategy here at UsherU and also run a business called Future of Film. The UsherU content discovery platform is the smarter approach to movie promotion. And you can find out more about this and us at the home of UsherU, which is usheru.com. So this is a show where we speak to the leaders in movie marketing and distribution to discuss the trends, tools and strategies that are shaping the industry, an industry that is in rapid change. And today I am delighted to welcome Kevin Goetz to the show. Kevin is the founder of Screen Engine, ASI, which conducts research for most of the movies that are released widely in the States and around the world. He has been nicknamed the Doctor of Audienceology and also the Movie Whisperer, based on his 30-year experience at this incredibly exciting intersection between production, creative process, and audiences. He's worked alongside all the major film studio chiefs, network and streaming platform executives, and production company decision makers. The Los Angeles Times magazine counted him as one of the most 100 influential and powerful people in Southern California. He's also produced 12 movies and brings both a marketing and filmmaking perspective to the interpretation of his research findings. He's a member of the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts and Sciences, and Kevin has channeled all of this experience and expertise into an outstanding new book, Audienceology: How Moviegoers Shape the Films We Love, which is coming out in February 22. I'm so excited to have this conversation today. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alex. It's really nice to be here.
Thank you so much. And firstly, congratulations on the book. I personally loved it as someone who's passionate about audiences and the creative process. It felt like it was very much I was your core audience for that. But I absolutely loved it. Highly recommended.
Thank you so much. That's really nice of you, Alex. I appreciate you endorsing it. It's certainly an inside view, isn't it? And also an area of the industry that not a lot of people, even film aficionados, know about.
Yeah, exactly. It really opens the lid on this process. And I guess because it happens in these movie theaters, doesn't it? Where it's very selective, and and people don't have access to that process. At what point did you think this is going to be a book?
Well, the book originally started as a textbook. And the reason I was writing it was because I teach at many of the film schools around the United States as a guest lecturer in the area of marketing and research in particular. And I wanted to have actually a piece of collateral material that I could leave behind and give the students to more specifically in a more detailed way express and explain what I do and the process of screening early, you know, test movies before they actually come out. And then it wasn't until about 3 or 4 years into that where I was having lunch with Sherry Lansing, who is the ex-Paramount chief and producer extraordinaire and really one of the most extraordinary women that I've ever had the pleasure of working with, and happy to call her a friend now, said to me, you know, honey, I think this is more than a textbook. I really feel this has nuances and understanding about consumers that would be really interesting to more than just film students. And so I went back to my co-author, Darlene Heyman, and we sat and talked about it. And we decided to make a really strong pivot into a movie book that was more for the movie lover, not necessarily the movie maker. And it turned out, I think, rather well, because there's so many entertaining stories that if you have a love for movies, to know that audience feedback created a lot of these changes, or certainly was the impetus for a lot of these, you know, small and some large changes in the movies that we've seen, is really acknowledging to the the people in the dark, as Norma Desmond says in Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, it certainly does that, and there are some fantastic stories on about some of the classic movies, movies which we really know very well, but they could have been potentially so different, or the results could have been very different. Tell me, perhaps, could you share one of those which you was perhaps most surprising, or you think is most instructive?
Oh, Lord. Well, having worked on over 7,000 titles, I can tell you that 6,900, probably 6,900 and some odd number, I don't even think it's even 100 of those, went through some change that prompted or aided in its success. Sometimes it didn't aid in its success, but it certainly didn't hurt what was already there. It just probably helped realize the filmmaker's vision even further. So it's really tough. I mean, the book is chock full of examples of small little things versus large things. I mean, one of the small things, for example, is I talk about Moonstruck, the movie with Cher and Nicolas Cage, and directed by Norm Jewison, which was a really fun movie. And really, it was a comedy, kind of a romantic comedy in a way, and very funny from the outset, except at the first test screening, people didn't really laugh until the middle of the movie. Like, it took them a long time to, maybe it was a little before the middle, but it was not at the outset. And that concerned the filmmakers. And we were doing two tests, one in New York City and one in Paramus, New Jersey, which was only less than an hour away, the next night. And so the first night we get scores back, you know, rating scores back from the audience, and they were average to very good, but the movie was very good to great. And it was like, why are they not embracing it more? And so the editor at the postmortem after at dinner time, after the screening, said, you know, we're opening the movie in a very serious way. They had an Italian sort of opera aria that was, you know, very serious but beautiful, but, you know, that, and it wasn't a clue for the audience to know that they had permission to laugh. So they changed it for the next screening the next night to "That's Amore," you know, "When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore." And it changed immediately the trajectory of the movie. And the audience knew from the get-go, oh, I can laugh here. And because of that, the scores went up like 20 points. The entire experience, because they didn't have to play catch-up or recovery or anything, was a far more entertaining one. And that little change made such a big difference. Another movie that comes to mind, which was, I think, a small little change, but was very, very impactful, for example, is a movie called Hope Floats. And that was with Sandra Bullock, and Forest Whitaker directed it. And the great Jenna Rollins played Sandra Bullock's mother. And in the movie, Sandra Bullock's character comes back to live with her mother, and I think then falls in love with what's his name? Oh my God, the singer, the jazz singer, who's
Harry Connick Jr.
Harry Connick Jr.
Yes,
yeah, Harry Connick Jr. Wonderful, 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 and so they like her character, but then what happens is her mother passes away. Her mother dies. And Sandra Bullock goes on with her life, seemingly as if nothing happened. At least the audience perceived it that way. And so when the scores and the comment cards came back afterwards, they weren't completely embracive of her character. And they're like, well, what's going on? She's Sandra Bullock. She's one of the most likable actresses and stars. But they felt that she was sort of selfish, that she didn't take the time to grieve her mother. Now, cut to, it's months later, Sandy's on to her next movie. She's changed her hair, cut her hair color, I think, both for the new part. What to do? So we all sat down and sort of said, what can we do here? And it was devised to have her, you know how women wear the towel when they come out of the shower around their head to, so it doesn't, you know, it dries and sort of, I don't know how they do that wrap, but, she comes out of her bathroom into straight into her mother's room as if by rote and forgets almost her mother's not there. And she goes into her mother's closet to borrow some piece of clothing, which is something that, again, we bought that this happened time and time again. She picks up a piece of a garment. She smells it and realizes her mother's gone and realizes that, oh my God, this is real. And she has a moment where she cries and writhes down the wall in a ball of tears, and the scores come up 20 points. Her character rating comes up 25 points because suddenly that little bit of humanity, that little bit of humanness, that little bit of compassion and grieving changed the whole arc of her character. So the audience told us, and so they didn't tell us how to fix it, but in fact, they told us what the problem was. And I thought that was extremely interesting and an example of, again, a tiny change, even solving the hair issue and then having a great result.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's often it comes across what comes across in the book is often it's very subtle. There's feedback from the audience. And then there's this creativity which comes from the filmmaking team to solve it, and to whether that's Spielberg reshooting the scene in Jaws where the head floats out of the ship
in Verna Field's pool. By the way, they went to her pool because they had to do it quickly, and they just put milk in the pool to create the cloudiness of the water, and they were able to match the shot.
Legendary. Love it. So, I mean, it's really fascinating. I suppose, this might sound a trite question of having just, had those examples, but why is testing so important, Kevin?
Well, I think I just expressed to you that that it certainly brings up issues that only the wisdom of crowds can sort of identify. But why it's important from a business standpoint is there is an absolute correlation between the word of mouth. And when I say the word of mouth, I mean the definite recommend scores. We ask a series of questions about, would you recommend the movie to a family or friend, member of your family or a friend?
Yeah. Can you dig into the scores a little bit? Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, I will. Let me just say that that particular highest box, the top box, definite recommend, is the most important barometer of if a movie is going to have longevity, legs, if you will, we call it legs, in the movie theaters. Now, of course, a lot of that's changing with streaming, but it still doesn't change the veracity, or what's the word, the intensity of what that measurement means. I mean, definite recommend is not probably recommend. If you're probably going to recommend it, you're probably not going to in the real world. So we only look at definitely. Even in the last 10 years, we look beyond definite. We look at passion and advocacy scores to see how definite you are. And are you going to be an advocate or, you know, an evangelist for this movie. So if you understand that definite recommend is that important, you know that that score is what we call the money score often. And that score, if it is at the norm, the normative level, let's say, average, you're looking at potentially a multiple that might only be 2.5 times its opening or 3 times its opening. I'm talking about a wide release. So if a movie opens at 10 million and it does a 2.5 times multiple, it's going to do $25 million US, I'm talking about right now, in its domestic life. If a movie opens to a 3.5 multiple, it'll do $35 million. Well, if you have an average definite recommend score, typically, and this is not every movie, but many, many movies, and that's why we have this data, you'll be in a certain multiple. But if you are 10 points above the norm or 20 points above the norm in that definite recommend, you could see a multiple of 3.5, 4, 5 times the opening, because people are going to be talking about it. And the other way is if you're 10 points below the norm or 20 points below the norm, you might be looking at a 2 times multiple. Now, think about the difference financially of what that means. So if you have a movie that opens in the US to $20 million, but it has the potential to open to $40 million, you understand that there's tens of millions of dollars of difference if the word of mouth is there, right? Does that make sense? So it's important to have a very strong number there. And the excellent and very good, which is how we rate, you asked about ratings, we rate a movie, almost every movie, almost since the history of being measured nearly 100 years ago, they used to ask, is the movie excellent, very good, good or bad or something? Now we ask excellent, very good, good, fair or poor. And if a movie is excellent, almost everyone who rates a movie excellent is saying they're definitely going to recommend it. And only half of those who say very good are going to definitely recommend it, almost on every movie. But if they're rating it good or fair or poor, they're not definitely recommending it. So that's why it's so important to make changes that get people more excited about the movie, because it's going to translate into excellence and very goods, which will translate into definite recommends. And that, again, is driving the business model, which almost everybody that I know who's in the movie business, not in the movie art, but in the movie business, cares about.
You're listening to the Movie Marketing and Distribution Podcast with me, Alex Stoltz. For more movie marketing tips, tactics, and strategies, head over to usheru.com/insights. Here we share the latest in marketing techniques and practical recommendations on how to apply these to your campaign. So that's usheru.com/insights. And now, back to the show. We talked there about the change, making changes to increase the score. We're also interested on this show about marketing and distribution. Are there examples of how the marketing has been changed or shifted direction based on the feedback you get?
Oh, sure. Screen? Many, many times. I mean, if a movie is sets out to be, let's say, a horror movie, and the earliest campaign, maybe they do a teaser trailer a year in advance, is horrific. And then you start testing your movie and you realize, hey, guess what? It's not very scary. It really is more of a thriller. And it's more of a psychological thriller at that. That is not a horror movie. If you sell it as a horror movie, you are going to really upset the audience. Not that I think you have to be completely accurate because it's not the truth in advertising department. It is the marketing department. So you want to do some kind of, you could do some kind of bait and switch to try to get people in the theater. That's usually when a movie is not playing that well and you know its multiple is not going to be that strong. It almost doesn't matter in a way. Does that make sense? Because you're going to try to take the big cash plays and get as many people as you can. But if you're in for the long haul, it's very hard to deceive people through marketing anymore, mainly because word travels so darn fast. Everything goes so quickly. It's warp speed. So people understand if you have a stinker or if you have a really great movie within hours of the first person seeing it. So it's much more difficult to not be honest out of the gate. So there are movies that, for example, comedies, that might be more black comedies or dark comedies, and they're sold more mainstream. And the audience sees them and, you know, they rightfully so, the marketing department marketed it more mainstream comedy because to market more as a quirky black comedy really sort of ghettoizes the movie and makes it more, in some ways, too specific and polarizes the comedy audience. They may say, well, I don't like that kind of comedy. So you want to be as broad as possible to open it up to as many people as possible. So where do they learn this? But in the screenings, they learn what kind of comedy and they learn what kind of suspense thriller and what kind of horror and how to what degree. And so then they also know what scenes and parts really resonate for audiences to use in the creative campaigns. And that's something that's very, very important. Although a trailer is not a movie or a, you know, a 30-second television spot is not a movie. It's, you can often have a challenged movie, but make a very, very compelling two-minute trailer because it's the story can be truncated. It's a very simple story. So it looks much more interesting in the trailer stage. On the other side of that, there's also very complex movies that are very, very difficult, particularly if they have lousy titles. I mean, often, you know, my feeling is no title lives in a vacuum, like Forrest Gump. You had no idea what that was, right? However, if you have to spend some time, any of your real estate in your advertising real estate, explaining a title too much, you don't have a great title. You know, you shouldn't have to work that hard. The exception, of course, are art house films. I'm looking at Moonrise Kingdom behind you in your poster behind, you know, that would be a difficult one to explain, but it's still an appropriate title. Actually, Forrest Gump turned out not to be such a difficult title once you had the visuals and knew that his name was Forrest Gump. And that whole campaign was built around Tom Hanks's character. But it's important to gain as much access as you can at a test screening for the marketing campaign. The other thing that we do that I think your listeners would have interest in is we believe at Screen Engine ASI, which is my company. Screen Engine ASI is a company that's been around for a dozen years. I started it literally in my living room, and then we now have 300 employees. And we test not only pre-release movies, but we also test advertising materials ad nauseum. We test, we conduct tracking surveys on how movies are going to open, exit polls on how they worked, both in the streaming world, television, and of course, movies. And you know, one of the things that I'm a big advocate of is do research early. Do research at what we call the capability stage, which is pre-green light, in order to understand what you have. Now, when they say what you have, it's not just should I make the movie, but it's how much should I spend on the movie? But it also gives you a marketing, early marketing roadmap. Because you just use a concept, really. You just use like a 200 to 300 word paragraph to identify, is this idea resonating for your audience? And then what we do is we we mine those words and phrases that really are exciting to audiences. And we give that to the marketing group at an early stage so that they can create advertising, not in a vacuum, not what one creative editor or producer thinks it should be, but what the audience is actually gravitating towards. Again, this goes back to the whole premise of audienceology. The whole premise of audienceology is to embrace the audience. This notion of wisdom of the crowds, that, you know, if somebody, Alex, if somebody hunks at you, you know, on the highway, on the roadway, and, you know, they're a jerk. But if three, four, five people start hunking at you, you know, you're the jerk. And I think it's important for, you know, filmmakers to listen to people. If someone says one thing, they could dismiss it as, well, you know, opinions are like, you know what, everyone has one, you know. But if people, 19 people out of a group of 20 focus group members are saying, this is super confusing and I don't get it, and the filmmaker is saying, I don't care, well, to me, that filmmaker is tone deaf. So it's important to listen to the audience. I think Ron Howard says it best. You know, Ron is a great filmmaker, Academy Award winner. You know, he talks about how he loves the screening process, and I can attest to that because I've worked on, I think, nearly every movie he's ever done. And he's interesting because he'll say, look, I get to choose the script I make. I get to work with the writer and make it just how I want it to be. Then I get to cast it. Then I get to hire the key people around it, the production designer, the costumer, the DP, et cetera. Then I get to shoot it my way. Then I get to edit it through the director's cut with my editor for 10 weeks or whatever it is. And then one day I give it to the audience. And that's where the rubber hits the road. And that is where I have to listen, because what I set out to communicate may not exactly be what the audience is getting or hearing or understanding. And I need to truly pay attention to realize my vision. And I don't know how, if it could ever be said better than that, because that is, to me, the most important aspect of the art of movie making. The art of it is, it's not a painting that you paint and you put away in the back of your closet if you don't like it. It's not a novel that if you write it and you don't like it, you shove it in the back of the drawer. It's a process. It's an art form that involves many key people bringing their A game, hopefully their A game, to the table to form this piece of art. Now, it is clear that it's either the director and or producer's vision, important to have a vision, but without all those other people, they couldn't make the art. And so who are you making it for? You're making it for the public. And with that comes a responsibility to make sure you're giving the people what they want. That doesn't mean you're creating the lowest common denominator. That doesn't mean that you're crafting something that is less than. It's actually, to me, very liberating and, again, validating to many filmmakers that what you're doing really works, or what you're doing isn't communicated as effectively as what you wanted. So we're giving you information. That's all. Whether you want to act on it is your prerogative. But this is what is being communicated.
Oh, thank you for that. I think it's absolutely fascinating. I love the idea around testing the concept at an early stage. That makes complete sense before you start spending all the big bucks.
But, you know, Alex, a lot of people think of that as a quote-unquote project killer. And it might be, but that's not the intention again. The intention is to say, what do you have? Be an adult about it. And don't overpay for something that doesn't have an audience that will ever support it. That's what you're saying. And it just means it's just good business sense. Again, every movie, if made and marketed for the right price, every single solitary movie will make money, should make money. They should, because if you know what you have, you know, if you make a movie about like dirt, soil, it may appeal to only, 6,982 Brits, right? That's it. That's all there, you know, in the whole country. And there's one website, it's a gardening website, and they're the only ones that are going to, are going to buy the rights to this in perpetuity, and they're going to pay you £15,000 for it. If you made it for £16,000, you're going to lose £1,000. You might be proud of yourself. I only made this for £16,000, but if you did your homework, you'd know it doesn't, to mitigate your risk, you shouldn't have gone over even that. And so that's what I mean by that. Understanding at the earliest stages what you have, sizing your audience the best you can through comp data, you know, comp other movies that did similarly. I have numbers, so I'm able to look at numbers compared to what they actually did, not what they thought they were going to do. I remember being in Cannes one year, and I was doing a talk back or some kind of presentation, and a young filmmaker came over to me and talked to me about this documentary. About a full-length feature she was making about the life of some very obscure person. And I said, uh-huh. I was very interested in it because I'm interested in obscure things. And I said to her, who is this movie for? And what do you think her answer was?
Everyone.
You got it. You're good, Alex. Alex, you're good. No, I mean, you are good because people say, well, I don't know, everyone. And I said, really? I can tell you right now that I can think of a dozen people and three would like it and seven would. So clearly, well, it's not a dozen, nine and three. Sorry. I had to do my math, but, I'm like, you can't say that. And then I said, and as a feature, what would you comp this to? So I basically talked her into making a documentary of this person's life. She balked. And I told her the price point and she balked more. I don't think the thing was ever made and it was a worthy subject, but she didn't want to hear the truth. All I'm providing is information. The original title of my book, by the way, Alex, was called Don't Kill the Messenger. And Simon & Schuster, the publisher, thought that audienceology would be more, I don't know, I guess, interesting, brand worthy, or less self-aggrandizing, perhaps, I don't know, or more about the audience and less about me. And I tested it. What did I do? I tested audienceology versus Don't Kill the Messenger. And within the industry, people really like Don't Kill the Messenger just a bit more. But outside of the industry, audienceology seemed to have an intrigue. And so we went with that. I'm happy I did because it does speak to, again, who is at the center of all this, and that is the people listening. And it's not to sound cloying or patronizing in any way, because one person doesn't necessarily make a difference, but a group of people watching a movie, giving their comments, and looking at those commonalities make huge differences. Although I want to also say there are certain circumstances. I remember being in a screening of a movie that was, a fun romp, but it never quite scored as well as it could have or should have. And I remember it was like the fourth or fifth screening. They had to lock. They were just really doing it just to make sure that what they did didn't hurt the movie. And the final scene of the movie is they were both digging for gold. And at the end, they found the gold. It was a treasure hunt kind of thing. They found the gold. And what they did is they donated it to the local museum, which is the right thing to do. And the audience was never quite satisfied. And it was, again the fourth or fifth screening. It was the end of my focus group. And one woman said, wow, I love that they gave it to the museum, but you know, I just wish they kept a little for themselves. And so what the audience really wanted was to have them win too. And so I cut to 15 years later. I'm working on a movie right now with the exact same issue. And I was able to bring forth that piece of advice from that woman in that focus group. And it's exactly what the studio did. It's a movie that's not out yet that will come out. And I think they did it right. And so there's vindication on that front. And but it was one person who made the comment that changed everything. Sometimes that one nugget is all you need to make that big difference.
Wow. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. I do want to ask, Kevin, where, what's the future of testing? Because we're in a rapidly changing entertainment landscape. Streaming is the norm now. The algorithms that companies like Netflix have to micro-target right. or to provide you, you know, to provide content, which for me, how does it work in the streaming landscape?
Sure. Well, the good news is that content is not going anywhere at all. People love content. They can't get enough of it. And movie theaters are changing. They're going to become much less relevant and really exist for a particular type of movie, an elevated, fun, almost a carnival ride, if you will. That's why the superhero movies do so well, both in their subject matter, so elevated, superhuman, taking us out of our body, really transporting us. Same in elevated horror movies. They seem to work often as well, like Scream, which opened in the States, you know, this last weekend, did rather well, you know, but not Spider-Man well. But the idea is that content will continue in many, many different, on many different platforms, in many different ways. And people continue to test all of their content. All of the streamers are testing their content, smartly so, because it may not be there to regulate the legs, but again, the streamers know that it's very difficult to discover a new show. It's very difficult to discover a new movie because they don't spend that kind of advertising dollars. And there's just so much content, out there. So they test it because they want to make it as realized and as good as it can be so that the word of mouth again is there, but not for the legs to hold in the theater, but for people to talk about it and create conversation around it, because it's the most important thing. So there's a business practicality, I guess, of keep testing for that reason. But as I said, from a creative standpoint, the smartest filmmakers, the best filmmakers know that it's super, super helpful. There's a movie right now that just came out. It's one of my favorite movies of the year. And the filmmaker had never really tested and was reticent to listen to the audience. And there was one particular line that created a context for the picture that the audience was asking for. And the filmmaker was reluctant to do it, and finally figured a way to do it without doing it as a line, but changing some of the beginning to allow us to, like a Moonstruck type of story, right? Like that. And from going to Over My Dead Body to implementing it, it changed the scores 25 to 30 points. And now they're in the Oscar conversation. So, you know, it's important to listen. There's only a handful of filmmakers around the world who will not test their movies or don't test their movies. And perhaps they think it's a badge of honor. And I have to say that having seen a few of those movies with some of those filmmakers, I would say it would have been a good thing had they tested them, because I find many things too long, a little too confusing, endings not satisfying, or as realized as they could be. And I think that's because they're not listening to you all.
Yeah. Well, look, this is, as I say, been absolutely fascinating. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Just what are your plans next, Kevin? Are you continuing to lean into the research? And
yes, I continue to. I'm the CEO of my company, Screen Engine ASI, in Los Angeles, and of course, we have an office in London. A company we just acquired called Tapestry. Shout out to Kevin Thompson and Ian Wright, who run it. Old colleagues of mine, and they're spectacular researchers, and really try to, what I do is uncover, you know, what are we doing? We're trying to uncover the truth, peel back those layers of the onion, you know, to get to the essence of what's really going on. So continue to run the company. Simon & Schuster has just offered me a second book, which will be titled How to Score in Hollywood. And it's a sort of a risk mitigation technique of that early screening stuff we that early research we talked about, as well as other things, with told through a lot of people's experiences of green lighting a movie and what does that mean and how did they arrive at it and did they make the right decisions or were they too hasty or were they too ignorant or were they too zealous, and to examine the notion of every movie, if made and marketed for the right price, should make money. And then I continue to work in my charitable endeavors. I'm very involved in different charitable. I sit on 5 boards, and then you know I have a very balanced life. I play tennis and piano, and just you know I'm not this. I realize it's not a dress rehearsal. You know, Alex, I actually live my life and enjoy it immensely. Very, very blessed.
Well, bless you, Kevin. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm going to take away the notion every movie correctly budgeted and researched can make money. I love it. And I think that's something we should all be pushing to. So, yeah, thanks again for taking the time.
And I know you said Kevin Goetz because I allowed that. It's Kevin Goetz.
I'm so sorry.
No, I just wanted to say that because Kevin Goetz is when I go to Germany, they'll say Goetz or Goetz. So I said, we'll let Alex have that.
I'm so sorry.
I'm good. Not at all.
I was gonna check it, and then I thought I'll be fine. Assumptions. It's always a downfall. Okay. Well, look, have a great day, and I look forward to the next exploration. Cheers.
My pleasure. Take care.
So thanks again for joining this episode of the Movie Marketing and Distribution Podcast presented by UsherU. At UsherU, we are passionate about data, innovation, and movie marketing. And we have now combined all of these passions and knowledge into a product that is built to, well, essentially transform film marketing. The UsherU Total Movie Hub is created to empower distributors and film bodies to build their own audience data and run outstanding campaigns that are both more cost-effective and impactful. To find out more about how UsherU can transform your campaigns and your marketing, just head over to usheru.com. You'll also find there more episodes of this show and an extensive selection of sessions and resources on distribution, audience strategy, and film marketing. And if you'd like to book a demo or have any questions, please just drop me a line at alex@usheru.com. I would be delighted to help and love to hear from you. So that's usheru.com, and I will spell that. That's USHERU, usheru.com. Do check it out, and I look forward to welcoming you back to the Movie Marketing and Distribution Podcast very soon.